From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida has been helping the Trump administration's immigration crackdown, but it seems compensation for that support has been slow in coming.
I feared that it would be exploited for political purposes.
Also this week, environmental lawsuits are stacking up against alligator Alcatraz in the Everglades.
Attorneys have a lot of concerns about pollution runoff, generators going all day.
We'll also check in with an expert to see if the Sunshine State might get more cold weather, and we'll grab some tools and build a granny flat in the backyard. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and our weekly wrap-up of top stories from the 2026 lawmaking session in Tallahassee.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org.
The U.S. Department of Justice is holding up federal funds meant to reimburse the state for costs associated with immigration enforcement. That includes Alligator Alcatraz, the immigrant detention facility in the middle of the Florida Everglades. We get more on the story from Tristan Wood.
Florida has spent $250 million on Alligator Alcatraz. Governor Ron DeSantis and other top Florida leadership have said the state will be reimbursed for those costs. But Florida Department of Emergency Management head Kevin Guthrie says that hasn't happened yet.
We have got $0 from the federal government.
Guthrie says the state is also awaiting reimbursement for other immigration enforcement efforts. His agency has spent almost $600 million on immigration enforcement since 2022. Starting in 2023, Governor Ron DeSantis has declared a state of emergency pegged on the issue, which he has renewed every few months, allowing his administration to use state emergency funds at his discretion. That power came under criticism from some Democrats during a recent Senate committee meeting.
We're basically approaching 20 times now for the immigration state of emergency. Isn't that excessive?
Orlando Democratic Senator Carlos Guillermo Smith says he voted against giving the governor that power in 2022.
I feared that it would be abused. I feared that it would be exploited for political purposes. And I regret that many of those fears have become reality. They've actually become nightmares, if I'm being honest. These are things that keep me up at night.
He and others have pushed to limit the rule to just pandemics and natural disasters, but Republicans didn't agree. Inverness Republican Senator Ralph Mazzullo says it's important for the governor to be able to act quickly in emergencies without needing the legislature.
The one we currently have 3.25 years ago was elected by a majority, an overwhelming majority of the Florida voters. And he sees this particular incident of the almost 10% of the money that was spent, as you mentioned, as an emergency, as a threat to our state. We could disagree with him, but that's not what this bill's about.
Zephyr Hills Republican Senator Danny Burgess says limiting the governor's ability to spend to certain emergencies could leave the state with no recourse if another type of disaster strikes.
That if we limit it and overprescribe it and we don't include the opportunity for man-made causes or disasters, we're missing things like mass shootings. I don't think we want to put ourselves in that type of a predicament.
It's unclear whether Florida will be reimbursed for any of the $600 million it has spent on immigration. I'm Tristan Wood.
It's not only politics that's an issue with Alligator Alcatraz. Two lawsuits are proceeding against the facility. One targets the environmental impact it's having on the fragile ecosystem of the Florida Everglades. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford and WUSF's Megan Bowman break out some of the concerns about the site's damaging effects on the protected wetlands.
Megan, you have been following the alligator Alcatraz, all the lawsuits and the legal challenges since its inception. Can you give us the latest update on the environmental lawsuit?
If you remember, the case was actually paused, and that was because federal attorneys put in an order basically saying, hey, we're furloughed during this shutdown. We can't work. So once the government opened back up, the plaintiffs and defendants have been filing all their paperwork, and oral arguments are scheduled to start the week of April 6th.
Governor Ron DeSantis has invested over $8 billion in Everglades restoration since 2019 to conserve the wetland environment. How does our state government balance conservation versus construction inside a national preserve?
One person I spoke with, Clyde Butcher, a nature and landscape photographer and a huge advocate for preserving the area, definitely believes that the governor's actions are directly contradicting his move with alligator Alcatraz. So like you said, the DeSantis administration has invested about $8 billion into restoring the Everglades. In November, the governor marked his 80th restoration event for the Everglades. DeSantis's website says he's done more than any other governor before. The same administration that has invested those billions also fast-tracked construction of the detention center. That was ready to go up and running in 8 days.
Now, we know that Big Cypress Preserve is home to really more than 100 endangered and threatened species, including the Florida panther. How could other animals that call the preserve home be affected by the construction of the facility?
Big Cypress is actually also an international dark sky place. It's one of the few places you can see the Milky Way at night. That light pollution is going to have really big impacts for a lot of the wildlife. So Center for Biological Diversity attorney Elise Bennett says they have heard lights from the detention center can be seen from up to 15 to 20 miles away. And that's a very big problem for species that rely on that dark sky, like the endangered Florida panther. Bennett says these lights are encroaching on the species' natural habitats. We actually were able to use NASA to look up some day-to-day light pollution, and even their satellites picked up a substantial difference between 2022 and when the detention center opened last year.
Now let's touch on drinking water. One in three Floridians, they rely on drinking water from the Everglades, according to the National Wildlife Federation. With the detention facility being built on top of this water source, what concerns are there for wastewater runoff and soil pollution?
Attorneys have a lot of concerns about pollution runoff, generators going all day, jet fuel being trucked in and trucked out, sewage trucked in and trucked out, and there's just this constant activity at the site. And they're really worried about runoff from that and pollution from all of that higher activity. And even when I went and visited the site, some of the places off of the Tamiami Trail, you know, a while ago, you used to be able to drive down and you would just hear nature. And just in the past few months when I've been down there, you have to go pretty far to stop hearing the sound even of the cars.
That was WUSF's Megan Bowman speaking with WGCU's Jennifer Crawford. A proposal to extend the life of a trust fund controlled by Governor Ron DeSantis for emergencies was advanced by a Senate Budget Committee this week over criticism of its use for immigration enforcement. The Republican-controlled Senate Appropriations Committee voted to keep the four-year-old Emergency Preparedness and Response Fund active through the end of 2027. Democrats, including State Senator Tina Pawlowski, continue to label the emergency cash a slush fund while questioning DeSantis's use of the money under the guise of a 2023 emergency regarding immigration, which he's reauthorized nearly 20 times in 60-day increments.
We can all agree the natural disasters make sense, but shouldn't we have oversight into something that's a kind of a made-up emergency that's been going on for 3 years with respect to immigration?
But bill sponsor Nick DeSegli says the immigration issue continues to be an emergency.
It's been pretty clear across this country that, you know, we've had an immigration problem. We have open borders for a number of years has created a significant crisis in our state and across our country.
Since being created, the legislature has approved $4.77 billion through 8 separate transfers for the fund, which currently holds about $210 million. Most of the money has gone to the state's response to hurricanes, with nearly $600 million over the past 3 years towards immigration enforcement. That includes around $245 million to build and initiate operations of that immigrant detainment center in the Everglades that the state has dubbed Alligator Alcatraz. Coming up on Capitol Report, at least for now, a court order has stopped President Trump's order to protect Haitian immigrants from immediate deportation.
I'm just waiting to see what's going to happen because he's unpredictable.
Florida driver license exams are no longer multilingual. That reverses the former policy of accommodating applicants whose English skills are lacking.
To see that we had gone through these great lengths to do this and then all of a sudden to pull the plug was quite a surprise.
And here's one affordable housing option. Build a so-called granny flat on your existing property and rent it out. Haitians have gotten a TPS reprieve, but they may still face deportation, as we hear from WLRN's Tim Padgett.
On Monday, a federal judge in Washington, D.C. blocked, for now, the Trump administration's cancellation of temporary protected status for Haitians. That TPS shields more than 350,000 Haitians in the U.S. from deportation. U.S. District Court Judge Ana Reyes said the Homeland Security Department's TPS termination process for Haitians violated the law and likely involved racial discrimination. But Haitian TPS holders like Maryse Baltazar know President Donald Trump will appeal Reyes's ruling.
I'm just waiting to see what's going to happen because he's unpredictable, very unpredictable. We don't know.
Baltazar is a former Haitian journalist who's now a certified nursing assistant in Boynton Beach. If she were deported back to Haiti, she'd have nowhere to live.
The earthquake destroyed my house and the other place I could have gone. The house was burned down by the gang members.
Baltazar is referring to Haiti's catastrophic 2010 earthquake, which is the original reason the U.S. granted Haitians TPS. She's also talking about the powerful armed gangs that now rule most of Haiti and recently torched her relative's home in Port-au-Prince. The gang violence has left 1.5 million people homeless in Haiti, yet the Trump administration claims it's safe to deport Haitians back there. But here's something else to know about Baltazar.
To work as a caregiver, it's a good sensation, and to help a World War II combat vet, that was an honor.
Baltazar is one of many Haitian TPS holders who provide home health care for elderly patients like that World War II bomber pilot veteran. She owns a tax-paying business. She helps run a nonprofit for women in crisis. TPS holders contribute up to $35 billion to the U.S. economy each year. Yet the Trump administration claims that extending TPS for Haitians like Baltazar, whose teenage daughter was born in the U.S., is not in the national interest.
For 15 years, I've been contributing like it was my own country. And as a good citizen, I would like to have the opportunity to watch my daughter graduate. I am anxious and scared because to return to Haiti, it will be like another earthquake.
Congress created TPS 35 years ago. It allows migrants from countries torn by natural disaster or political violence to stay in the U.S. for 18-month periods or longer if those countries remain unsafe to return to, as legal experts say is the case regarding Haiti. Chicago attorney Jeff Pipoli represents Haitians in the case Judge Reyes ruled on.
The president and his administration were resolved to end TPS for Haiti come hell or high water. But all this evidence of how unsafe it is in Haiti is so overwhelming that to conclude the opposite suggests that the process that you use to reach this conclusion is broken and contrary to the TPS statute.
In Miami over the weekend, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem argued that TPS has too often morphed from a temporary protective program for migrants to a quasi-permanent one.
Under the Biden administration, we saw it abused and not utilized how law dictates. President Trump is restoring that.
But Judge Reyes also said it was likely the Trump administration's efforts to end TPS, not just for Haitians, but Venezuelans and other Black and Latino groups, reflects a hostility to non-white immigrants. Steve Forrester is the Miami-based immigration policy coordinator for the nonprofit Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti.
Trump has given many, many indications of this anti-Black, anti-non-white ideology. But if Haiti TPS is removed, the devastation that this is going to cause is unprecedented, a literal death sentence for lots of people.
The Trump administration denies the racism charge, but Maurice Baltasar, the Haitian TPS holder in Boynton Beach, agrees that being deported back to Haiti could be deadly. The UN estimates the country's gangs were responsible for more than 6,000 murders last year.
Let me tell you something. People can be victimized anywhere. Don't get me wrong. But when you have the certainty that if you go out today, you might not return home, it's another story.
A story that's still possible for more than 350,000 Haitians in the U.S. I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
Well, starting today, Florida driver's license exams will be given in English only. WMNF's Chris Young has more about what the mandate means for Florida's large immigrant population.
In Hillsborough County, over 37% of driver's license exams in 2025 were given in a language other than English. So when the county's tax collector, Nancy Milan, first heard about the new mandate from the state, she says she was shocked.
This has been going on for a fairly long time where we've offered these exams not only in Spanish, but we've offered it in Chinese, Vietnamese, Portuguese, Haitian Creole, all of those different communities that really make the population of Hillsborough County. And we were addressing those by offering them in multiple languages. So to see that we had gone through these great lengths to do this and then all of a sudden to pull the plug was quite a surprise.
In a press release, the Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles says the state is taking a, quote, leading role in highway safety by requiring all driver's license exams to be taken in English and without an interpreter. But Milan says she's worried the rules may lead to more drivers without proper credentials.
This is a decision that came from the state. And again, I understand the need for us to really abide by the laws and comply with these things for safety reasons and so forth. But perhaps maybe not pulling the plug so quickly and maybe a phased-in approach might have been better.
Asia Claremont is the state director of the League of United Latin American Citizens in Florida. She says the new rule creates unnecessary barriers for law-abiding citizens and also expressed concern about voter suppression.
Because if you don't have a license, you're not able to vote. So that is going to also quiet the voices of the community that has contributed tremendously into the economy of the state of Florida.
The Florida Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles did not respond to WMNF's request for comment. I'm Chris Young.
Much of Florida saw freezing temperatures last weekend. North Florida had snow flurries, and some record low temperatures were recorded around the state. This follows last year's week of ice in the panhandle. Even though it may seem like we're getting more cold periods than normal, studies show otherwise. Gina Jordan talked about that with Florida State University professor and climate scientist Jeff Chanton.
The Arctic is warming four times faster than the rest of the Earth. And the hypothesis goes that as the temperature gradient or the temperature difference between the Arctic and the equator lessens, that the jet stream becomes more wobbly and brings more frozen air down to us here in the Deep South. So I looked into all this, and that was what I thought, too. Yeah. But I talked to several of my colleagues in my department, the Department of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Science here at FSU, and I came away with a completely different idea. It turns out that, well, of course, everyone knows the climate is very noisy. There's a lot of variation in the climate, and variability is a really hard thing to measure. And so what we're talking about here is an increase of variability in winter such that it's colder and warmer in winter. But there's an organization called Carbon Brief that just looked into this question. And this email came to my colleague, Michael Diamond, and I also talked to my colleague, Allison Wing. They were both very helpful. And what this information showed is that we're not having colder cold spells here in Tallahassee for the last 50 years from 1970 to the present, the coldest nights actually have gotten warmer over time. So from 1970 to the present, our coldest nights, there's a trend for those to be warmer. And there's another trend such that these cold periods don't last as long. So this is all consistent with global warming or climate change, as we now call it. We still have cold extremes, but those cold extremes are not as cold as they used to be or as long as they used to be. So we're looking at milder winters.
Interesting. Okay. Last year, we had the infamous ice storm in January. We've just come off of a very cold weekend where lots of faucets were dripping. So when you see the Big Bend dealing with our version of these deep freezes, mm-hmm. what does that signal to you as a climate scientist, especially given what you just told us?
It signals to me that it's weather. And weather is the variability about the mean that is climate. There's just always this enormous natural variability. And that's what we're experiencing right now. But there is a trend in that variability such that the cold periods that we get over the last 50 years, it's measured. They are measured to be shorter. They're measured to be warmer.
Okay. So we have a warming planet, but still it can make for extremely cold air in places like Tallahassee. And even this past weekend, I think I heard it hit 50 degrees in Key West. So can you just give us a little bit of the science behind warming planet, but cold mm-hmm. air reaches Key West?
So if you think of it as a line of data getting warmer and warmer, the average is that warmer and warmer. But the variability, the noise around that trend is remarkable. And that's why I always tell my classes, for environmental data, you really have to have a long-term record because it's hard to tell the signal from the noise. And so the weather that we're experiencing now, that's noise. But the trend is still warming. And let's not forget that when you take the overall mean temperature of the planet, the warmest 3 years have been the last three. And if you go back 10 years, the warmest 10 years have been the last 10. There's just no doubt about it. The Earth is getting warmer, and there's a number of reasons for this. One is the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane, nitrous oxide, those are increasing. Another reason is that as the ice on the planet shrinks, you get less and less reflectance of solar radiation. You get more absorption of solar radiation, and particularly in the Arctic, when you change from sea ice to open water, the reflectivity decreases remarkably. And so we absorb more heat on the Earth. And then another thing that has happened is we've removed sulfur-containing compounds from a lot of our fuels and reduced the aerosols that are in the air. And when you get rid of aerosols, you absorb more sunlight. And so those three trends are resulting in a warmer planet.
That was FSU climate scientist Jeff Chanton speaking with WFSU's Gina Jordan. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, state lawmakers have a proposal to give homeowners the right to build and rent additional living space on their property. The bill allowing accessory dwelling units unanimously passed the Florida Senate this week, and it's working through the House. The bill could be an answer to the state's affordable housing crisis. WUSF's Gabriella Paul takes us to a master planned community in Bradenton that is on the cutting edge of these units known as ADUs.
15 minutes from Anna Maria Island in West Bradenton, a massive master plan community is underway. It's more than 1,000 acres of land that used to be a flower farm. Now, it's sprouting hundreds of new homes. Off the main entrance, a town center, complete with a Publix, is coming soon. And periodically, big teal street signs invite you to discover Seaflower, a Gulf Coast community. Ed Hill is the guy in charge.
Hi, we've got the welcoming committee here.
Yes, Ed Hill. Yes, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
I came out to greet you, not just because I wanted to shave you steps, but some of the story about the ADU kind of starts with the streets and the way we...
They made room for on-street parking and built lots of roundabouts to slow traffic. Most of the homes have extra space, too.
Back in 2015, we came to the county and said, your rules currently don't exist for what we want to do. And you can see right in the approval, I highlighted for you, a small ancillary building should be permitted within the backyard of each house to be used as a rental apartment or a place to work.
They're called accessory dwelling units, or ADUs. Some people call them granny flats or mother-in-law suites. Imagine a converted garage or a backyard studio separate from the main home. And more than a decade ago, Hills Development got special permission from Manatee County to incorporate them into their home designs. He shows me one of several options.
It's attached by a breezeway.
Okay, so this right here to the right is the primary residence. This is technically a detached accessory dwelling unit?
It's a detached garage with an accessory dwelling unit above. So you've got a functioning, if you walk to the back here, you've got a functioning three-car garage. And in this case, that allows you a full apartment above with living space, a bedroom, a full bath, and a kitchen.
Floor plans like this could become more common in Florida. Lawmakers are once again considering a proposal that would give homeowners the right to build and rent out extra living space on their property. If it becomes law, cities and counties would have to allow the extra units wherever single-family homes are allowed. Cody Glazer with the Florida Housing Coalition says that policies like this are gaining popularity across the country.
There are already 18 other states that have done what Florida is trying to do in terms of standardizing ADUs statewide. And they're both blue states, the red states. It's just part of the national trend that we're seeing is more states stepping in on this kind of thing.
The hang-up for Florida lawmakers is how or whether to keep the units from being listed as Airbnbs or VRBOs. That question killed a similar proposal last year. Rebecca O'Hara is a lobbyist representing the interests of Florida cities. In a recent hearing, she told representatives the House version of the bill doesn't give local governments enough oversight.
This turns a promising affordable housing strategy into a party house bill. Now these investors will be able to double the parties and their profits by cramming accessory dwelling units onto a lot with an existing short-term rental.
The Senate version is trying to address that by allowing local governments to prohibit rentals of less than a month. The developers of Seaflower and Bradenton are also grappling with these issues. Hill says they settled on a minimum rental period of 6 months.
We've been very careful about what the rental program is and what it can be to make sure it doesn't turn into a resort community.
Owners are also required to live in the main house for a year before renting.
The idea of an accessory dwelling unit for this location was one built on that. It perhaps could be a solution for affordable housing. It also could be an extension for multi-generational living.
That was a selling point for buyers Jerry and Dave Servery. Once it's built, their home will have a live-above apartment on top of a three-car garage. They haven't settled on what it will become, but Jerry says that's the beauty of it.
There's a lot of features with an ADU, a lot of benefits. It's just a great flex space and a lot of options.
Place to stick grandkids to.
They said it will probably be a space for guests and eventually live-in care. They live with Jerry's 99-year-old dad, and they're aging themselves. But they aren't counting out the idea of listing it as a rental someday. I'm Gabriella Paul in Bradenton.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Jennifer Crawford, Megan Bowman, Tim Padgett, Chris Young, and Gabriella Paul. Technical support for Capital Report comes from T.C. McGuire, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week, on air and online, for more reports from the state capitol.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.